Accused is nominated for a People's Choice Webby Award for Best Writing. If you're a fan of the work we've done, please consider casting a vote for Accused at bit.ly/accusedwebby or go to vote.webbyawards.com and vote in the Best Writing Podcast category. Voting is open until April 20th. I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the Unsolved Murder of Elizabeth Andes. On the last episode...
And it's only in the, you know, in the 1970s that we begin to suddenly see this dramatic rise in these unsolved homicides that seem similar, could potentially be linked together. Ted Bundy's kind of our archetypical modern or postmodern serial killer.
In today's world of forensic files and CSI, it's tough to imagine a universe without DNA.
A tiny piece of a latex glove and some broken glass were the only clues.
I always loved Peter Thomas's intros on forensic files. His rundown of the minute physical evidence used by scientists to ruin otherwise perfect crimes always made me think of a super nerdy MacGyver or something. But alas, even the TV shows based on real life oversimplify just how tough crime solving can be, especially when you're dealing with a cold case. When Beth Andes was killed in 1978, no one had heard of DNA. Fingerprints were standard and polygraphs were cutting edge, but DNA wouldn't be used in a criminal trial for 8 long years. It'd be even longer before police departments were trained in how to properly collect it.
It's one of those things. This happened before I was even born, so...
I hear it. Yeah, I was 2 months old.
For me to jump in and take a look at this thing, it's definitely interesting in a study in police practices in the 70s.
Oxford Lieutenant Jeff Robinson is a 35-year-old man investigating a 37-year-old case.
In fairness, you know, my eyes looking at it, I'm looking at it with 2015, 2016, I think when I went to the VDOC, it was, 2014. I'm looking at it with eyes through those lenses.
Robinson's talking here about the VDOC Society, the volunteer group of forensic experts we introduced in Episode 3.
And one of the things that when I was at VDOC we talked about was, you know, things that could have been done differently. And in talking with those professionals at that group, they were very impressed and they were very complimentary of the work that was done in 1978 and 79.
Oh, great.
Certainly things have changed, and certainly things that we do are much different today. But for what was available and the practices of the day, they were very complimentary of that group and that organization in the 70s, you know, from all standpoints, whether it's the police department, the crime labs, the prosecutor's office, everybody was very complimentary of the job that was done back then. And so I don't want to take away from what they did. You know, and unfortunately, people look at it and say, well, why don't you have this? Why don't you have that? Well, those things just weren't done then, you know?
Right. It's the prism of today's, yeah.
Who'd have thought I could walk in a crime scene today, take a cotton swab and rub it on a doorknob and be able to tell you everybody that's touched that doorknob in the past, you know?
Right.
2 weeks. Today's day and age, I think we would have had this thing solved pretty quickly, or at least had leads pretty quickly. Technology just wasn't available back then that we have now.
Now, whether the VDOC Society was entirely complimentary of the 78 investigation is debatable. Remember, profiler Richard Walter told me...
The fact of the matter is it sloppy? Yes.
But that doesn't mean he said the same to Robinson. Still, the truth is that things done as a matter of course today just weren't done when Beth Andes was killed. And it wouldn't be fair to fault the police for not being clairvoyant. Surely that explains why there were no doorknob swabs or fiber sweeps or modern-day rape kit tests. The officers on the scene didn't even wear gloves. I know this because every cop who walked into the scene had to be fingerprinted to match against prints lifted from Beth's bedroom. Even Police Chief Joseph Statham's prints are in the case file. Changing times explains some of what appears today as sloppy, but it doesn't explain everything.
unfortunately, a lot of the things that we would need to try to take this case to a trial at this point, this juncture, in this day and age, we just don't have anymore.
That's kind of been passed along to me in bits and pieces. What does that mean, though? Is all the evidence gone?
I don't want to say all of it, but I think a lot of things are not around.
Do we? So if you don't mind, I'm just going to ask, do you have the scissors still?
No.
This is another one of those "are you kidding me" moments in this case. My producer, Amanda, and I were told early on that a lot of the evidence has been misplaced. According to Andy's family lawyer, Deb Leiden,
they have lost that sewing kit. They've lost the scissors. They've lost the clothing from Beth. They've lost everything except paperwork, written reports and so forth. Well, they say they've lost it.
We can give the police a pass for not knowing about DNA in 78, but not for misplacing evidence. Since long before Jack the Ripper, it's been standard police practice to hold on to murder weapons and bloody clothes. I'm being careful here to say it's misplaced because I refuse to believe it's lost forever. I'm reluctant largely because no one is able to say for sure when the evidence went missing, which is insane to me. I've seen the kind of detailed chain of custody that typically is associated with boxes of evidence in criminal trials. When it's destroyed, there's usually paperwork involved. Here, we know that all of the items were around for the 1979 trial, and then they were admitted in the 1983 civil case. After that, there's a notation that indicates a courier named Bruce Horner picked up the evidence from Cleveland, where the civil trial was held, to deliver it back to authorities in Butler County, but there's no notation of it ever having arrived. When I talked with some officials, they said mind-boggling things that implied they didn't have a clue what usually happens with evidence. Here's me talking with Steve McHugh, an attorney for the Oxford Police Department.
Well, if it was returned, then it probably would have been returned to the family. I'm not sure. I can't speak where the prosecutor did with it.
Well, I mean, like the scissors that were supposedly the murder weapon wouldn't have been returned to the family, would they? I mean, within...
Let me ask the chief.
I know, I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, because you're asking me, I mean, that's a legitimate question. I just don't know.
I checked with the family, and no, the murder weapon scissors were not returned to them. I was so surprised about that being suggested that I asked former Chief Steve Schwein about it. He had worked as Oxford's police chief from 1990 to 2011 and had tried to get the case reopened.
Would it make sense to you that the evidence would have been returned to Beth's family?
Never. Never.
That's what McHugh told me might have happened.
Never. Never. Ever.
So this is the heart of this episode, our search for the evidence. If this were a 1980s movie, this would be our musical montage moment.
You have reached the public affairs section of the Hamilton Police Department. After the tone, please leave a message and we'll contact you.
Hi, this is Amber Hunt. I'm a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. I'm actually looking for some evidence.
Butler County Commissioner's Office, this is Erica. How can I help you?
Hi, Erica. My name is Amber Hunt. I'm a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer.
Yes.
Okay. So this is a complicated one, but I'm going to make it as painless as possible, I swear. So okay. I'm doing a story.
Clerk's office.
I am working on a story about a case, and basically I'm trying to figure out if the evidence in said case is still in your courthouse.
That the case had been sealed by Bob Young to make his life a bit easier made things all the more difficult for me because I couldn't just spout off a case number. I had to explain that it had been sealed. But no, really, you're allowed to talk to me about it. I pinky swear. Sometimes they seem like they believed me.
Sorry to keep you waiting. I'm not finding anything.
You're not finding anything? As in, you don't see right in the case? Or
I'm not finding a case, no. Mm-mm.
Other times, not so much. I talked with Gary Yates, administrator of the Butler County Courthouse. He told me he wouldn't even look for case evidence because of the seal. You can't just peek and make sure there aren't any stray boxes with, I don't know, bloody scissors inside, I asked. No dice. That's when Deb Leiden stepped in and declared me an official Andy's family designee with whom this case could be discussed, seal be damned. Yates eventually replied via email. quote, I had our evidence custodian search the evidence room located in the Butler County Courthouse for exhibits related to this case. After a lengthy search of old exhibits, no exhibits in the custody of the Butler County Common Pleas Court were discovered related to this case, end quote. He also mentioned that a judge thought maybe the evidence had been destroyed in a fire or a flood. He closed the email by saying, quote, even though this matter is of great importance to the family, I don't know of any further assistance the court can offer in securing the items sought by the Cincinnati Inquirer, end quote. If the cops don't have it, and the courts don't have it, and the family doesn't have it, maybe we should just write it off as missing forever, right? That's what I asked Mark Godsey. He's the director of the Rosenthal Institute for Justice and the Ohio Innocence Project.
So when you have encountered somebody saying, this is lost, do you have any over under on the likelihood that it actually is lost?
I give that no credence whatsoever until we've done everything we can do to check every single possible place it could be, including the court reporter who was in charge of the case. We found cases where the court reporter took it home and put it in her garage afterwards. And so until we run down every single thing after brainstorming, we could think of where it could possibly be, and we've double-checked it. And then we've looked under every possible name and co-defendant and victim and everything else. Then we sort of say, okay, maybe it's lost, but if it, you know, but if it's not, we can't think of anything else to do to try to find it. So just the statement that it's lost doesn't mean much to me.
Okay. All right, well.
Not that I think anybody's lying. I just think
no, but they might not know, right?
Godsey knows a lot about supposedly lost or destroyed evidence. He estimates that he's encountered it in about three-quarters of the cases his organization weighs.
And even worse than that, the record-keeping is often very bad. So, you know, a lot of times you just can't find where it is. There will be one record saying that the file was submitted to this court, and then you go to that court, and the record will say, you know, it was never sent here, you know, and things like that. So it just becomes like a wild goose chase.
So Amanda and I started chasing. We began with the Oxford Police Department. Here's longtime veteran John Buchholz, who eventually became assistant to the chief. We talked with him in the department lobby, and he told us about how Schwein tried to reopen the case after he had joined the department in 1990.
If I remember right, that I can remember in the early 90s going down to the Butler County Courthouse to retrieve some of the evidence and things like that, and found out that it was stored in the basement, and during a flood, everything was destroyed.
That's how we've heard.
Yes, that happened back in the early 90s that we were, because our original chief, not our original, but the one that came in 90, Steve Schwein.
Schwein, okay.
Okay, he was really hot on this as being a cold case. You know, even though, you know, everybody knew or thought they knew that, you know, the boyfriend did it, you know, that he was really hot on it all the time, never let it go. And that's how we found out that half the crap was gone.
We had heard this a few times, that there was a flood in the courthouse basement, but no one could tell us precisely when it happened or what all had been destroyed. Before Amanda and I started asking questions, it seemed like no one was really that concerned that they couldn't find the evidence. Which I guess makes sense if you're absolutely sure Bob Young is the killer and can't, thanks to Double Jeopardy, be tried for it again anyway.
Because the only thing that was really destroyed, as far as I remember, would have been the actual physical evidence.
Right, the stuff that would convict somebody.
Right.
That's kind of the important stuff.
What if he stuck in there and turned the water faucet off?
It might sound odd that we're laughing here about something that's obviously serious. Aside from that being kind of my go-to during interviews, it's also because this was one of our first interviews on the case. We didn't know yet how things would unfold. After I talked with Buchholz, I combed newspaper clips and saw no coverage of any courthouse flood. So I asked Mary Swain, who's not only the clerk of courts, but also something of a local history buff. She did remember some pipes bursting and damaging some files, but that happened in about 2005, and several people, including Buchholz and Schwein, said they'd gone to look for the physical evidence long before that, but couldn't find it. As I cold called dozens of places looking for any clue about these missing clues, I was directed at one point to Butler County's Records Center.
Okay, the director's name is Rhonda Fries.
I called Fries, and she sounded enthusiastic when she said she'd do some digging. But the return call I got wasn't what I was expecting.
This is Rhonda Fries from Butler County Records Center. Getting back with you regarding the inquiry you made pertaining to a 1978 criminal case, and to let you know that the Ohio Revised Code 2933.82, that became effective in year 2010, and it did not have any grandfathering or retroactive clause.
This is all legalese. In English, it means that in 2010, a law was enacted dictating that all evidence in murder cases without convictions should be kept indefinitely. Godsey of the Innocence Project actually helped draft that law because his organization got so frustrated by how often evidence seemed to disappear in life and death cases. But Fries's message to me sounded more about liability. She made a point to say that this law wasn't enacted until long after Beth Andes was killed, which had nothing to do with my search for the evidence. So I called her back.
Hey, Rhonda, it's Amber from the Enquirer.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for the call. I'm not going to sue you.
So, oh, no.
It's okay.
I knew that.
Okay.
I knew that you were researching for that record because actually I was curious about this one as well.
After we cleared that up, she told me she couldn't find any records about where the evidence had gone. Then she directed me to someone else, who directed me to someone else, who directed me to a woman she was sure would be helpful, whose name was Rhonda Fries. This is what Godsey meant by wild goose chase.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So if the evidence isn't in Oxford or at the Butler County Courthouse, I thought maybe I'd check with the very last place we knew it was for certain. That's the federal courthouse in Cleveland where the civil trial was held in 83. Schwein told me that it should have been returned after the trial.
But it never made its way back to the Oxford PD property room where it should have rested, especially in light of the fact, either way, it should have made its way back. After the criminal trial, come back. If it has to go to the civil, that's fine. It should come back. Guilty or not guilty, it should have been in repose in OPD's evidence fault, either number one for further investigation, if in the case of not guilty, which it was, or number two in the case of guilty, an appeal down the road should have come back to hear.
So either way, conviction or no conviction, the protocol would have been to keep it in a specific place at the Oxford Police Department.
Almost any place you go, I believe that would be the protocol.
So I called the federal courthouse in Cleveland and described what I was looking for to Operations Supervisor Robert Pitts.
Okay, that sort of stuff, evidence itself, those things, that's all returned to counsel at the conclusion of a trial. The clerk's office don't keep any of that kind of stuff.
Okay. So what is it, and can you say definitively that that's the protocol, like it's always done this way?
Yes. Yes. So maybe a long time ago, perhaps there was, the clerk's office may have held on to evidence, but as long as I've been around, it's been 21 years, we have never kept evidence. That's always been returned to counsel at the end of the trial.
And how is it returned? Is it, like, packaged up? Is it labeled?
It's however they gave it to us. Anything that went back to a jury, however they presented it in court, that's how it's returned. If they had it in a box, brought it in a box, and presented it to the jury, it goes back to the jury in the box. The jury looks at it, considers it, and put it back in the box and give it back to counsel.
And which counsel? The plaintiff?
Whoever evidence it was, whoever presented the evidence.
Okay, so whoever brings it in, it goes back to them.
If it was in plaintiff's case in chief, then plaintiff's counsel received it. If it was a defendant exhibit, then defense received it. Yeah, we never hold on to any evidence.
There's no storage, and I'm sorry to hammer this home, but I just want to make sure I don't misunderstand. There is no storage where you guys have evidence kept there?
No.
What about during the trial? Is it kept anywhere?
During the trial, anything like drugs, money, firearms, that's all returned to counsel at the end of every night. At the end of every night, even? Yeah. We never hold on to that kind of stuff.
This is one of more than two dozen calls I've made trying to find this evidence. I've called courthouses and lawyers. When I've learned that one affiliated lawyer has died, I've called his children, his ex-wives, and the institutions with which he worked, all in hopes of figuring out where he might have stored a box of evidence if it happened to have been given back to him. I've had hopeful moments like this one when I was sick and lost my voice.
So what did they find?
The file.
Like what's in it?
I don't know. You know what's in it. What the hell is this all about? Hey, wait a minute. Just a minute. Hey, can you hang on about 30 seconds?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, because I'm going to record you.
Oh, no problem. I don't mind.
Okay, you're being recorded now, all right?
All right.
Who am I talking to again?
My name's Amber Hunt. I'm a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer who happens to have laryngitis.
Dick Walsh never knew anything about Beth Andes, but he's a Cleveland lawyer who helped sort through the files of Andes' family attorney Paul Markstrom after Markstrom died. Markstrom had instructed that his files be left to the state Supreme Court for sorting and filing, though Walsh didn't remember whether the Andes file was included in the bunch. This first call was him telling me that, yes, the file was found in Supreme Court storage. I was elated, but I had to wait for the file to be shipped to Walsh before I could learn what was in it. A week later, I found out.
His notes and things like that.
Okay. Is there, are they handwritten notes? No scissors. Okay.
No scissors.
I had Supreme Court personnel do a search through all of its files to see if an unlabeled box of evidence could be located.
I had my staff look through those boxes, and they did not find anything.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
So we have officially checked, huh?
Yep, we've officially checked. We went through all the boxes. I had them pull them, and they went through them this morning.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep, no problem.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Most people have been empathetic with my search.
That's a big task.
You have no idea, man. Thank you for the empathy.
It has been exhausting, and as common as Godsey says it is for evidence to be lost in a case, he still doesn't say there's any excuse for it.
My goal here is to kind of to be the bad cop. So if you have a municipality, though, that has had two murders in the past quarter century, and one of them is unsolved, isn't it kind of reasonable to think that they might hold on to the evidence in that case?
Yeah, I would say in an unsolved case, that would be much more unusual. We don't deal with unsolved cases. I'm only looking into ones where somebody's in prison and claiming they're innocent.
Right.
I would find that highly unusual that the evidence would be missing in an unsolved case.
Okay, so I was hoping you would tell me how wrong I am, but you're not.
Right.
Okay. Oh, all right.
Earlier, I mentioned a guy named Bruce Horner. He apparently worked as a courier for some time, so I thought, well, maybe he picked up the evidence but never got around to delivering it, Or maybe he tried to deliver it, but was shooed away for one reason or another. Maybe it's still in his basement somewhere after all these years. Deb Lydon found him, or, more accurately, she found an obituary stating that Sergeant Bruce Edward Horner of the U.S. Army, quote, danced through the pearly gates in 2007 while serving his country in Iraq. I found Horner's brother through email and apologized for the intrusion, but told him what I was looking for and the off chance it was still in storage somewhere. The brother politely replied that he couldn't help me. I went back to the conversation I had with Godsey of the Innocence Project.
Okay, so if I'm dealing with a small police department in Ohio, and I've checked with the courts and the department and a federal court where there was a civil case, I must be missing some avenues that I wouldn't know to go down.
Did you check in? Well, I guess there was an acquittal, so it didn't go to the Court of Appeals. It doesn't say you could check the Court of Appeals.
Right.
I would look at any other departments that were involved in it, because a lot of times, take a small municipality, they'll bring in the sheriff's department, they'll bring in the FBI or somebody else. And it's hard to find that out unless you get some sort of file or transcript from the trial to see if there's any other departments that were involved.
Right.
I would check with the court reporter, if you can track down who the court reporter was all the way back then.
I checked with the county, with the City of Hamilton Police Department, with the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigations, all of which assisted in this investigation, but I had no luck. So I took Godsey's advice and went the court reporter route, starting with Frank Versace, who's listed as one of the reporters in the civil trial.
I'm working on a case from 1978, in which you were the court reporter.
Get out of here. Oh, my God.
I know.
That must have been one of my first depots. That's the year I started. But anyway, obviously, if you're asking for some kind of copies of transcripts, A, the firm I was working for at that time, this is before I started my own firm, has disbanded. They're all dead. And B, we wouldn't have anything from 1978 anyway.
No, I to be honest, what I'm looking for is even a longer shot than that. I reached out to somebody from the Innocence Project to ask how they sometimes find evidence that has been misplaced, and they suggested checking with the court reporter. That's why I'm calling.
Okay, well, obviously I don't have anything from 1978.
No, of course not.
Why are you even on this case? I don't get it. That was 38 years ago.
Because it's still involved.
God, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
I decided to switch gears and track down the court reporter in the original criminal trial. Her maiden name was Olga Watkins. She graduated from Miami University in 1977. Later, she went to the University of Dayton Law School before becoming a lawyer in 1992. Her obituary states she practiced law with her husband for a decade before retiring, and then she died in May 2014 while in hospice care. According to her obituary, she'd been married by the time she graduated Miami, and her new name was Olga Moser. Her husband was Michael Moser, the prosecutor on Bob Young's case and the lead prosecutor in Butler County now. We've been trying throughout the reporting of this project to talk with Michael Moser. After learning that his wife was the original court reporter and learning that the Innocence Project has several times found lost evidence with these reporters, we went back to his Butler County office to try once again to talk with him.
I'm sorry, he's in a meeting. Can I take your number or something? He's wanting to call you.
I've left a lot of messages, so I was hoping to chat with him. Do you know when he'd be done with this meeting?
No, I don't.
I mean, we'd be happy to wait.
No, he would not be able to come out yet. I'm not sure when it'll be done.
Okay, but I mean, we could wait.
No, it's okay.
Okay, but I've left messages for 6 months now.
Okay, and all I can do is give you the messages.
Is it possible to get the courtesy of a reply?
Well, like I said, I can take the message and give him the number, and that's all I can do.
Is there a reason he won't take?
I don't know. That's not something that I'm privy to.
Okay. Because I've been a journalist for 20 years. I've never had a prosecuting attorney flat out refuse to say at least no comment. Sorry.
Well, like I said, all I can do is take a number, and and give it to him, and that's all I can do.
Yeah, and I do understand that you're, you know,
the liaison here.
I do. but it's, I mean, you're going to take my number, and if anything, it's going to be, I'm not going to hear from him because I've been doing this for 6 months.
Yeah, like I said, that's all I can do. And I will do my best.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it's hunt, H-U-N-T, right?
Right, like going hunting.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi there.
Do you know where Mr. Moser is?
He's probably not in his office, but did you?
No, I did.
Yeah, we did.
I'm kind of joking. Yeah. I've been here like 15 times. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did they try and suggest that you just, instead of making 15 attempts, just get an appointment?
We've tried that too. We don't get a response when we ask for an appointment.
No, that's not like it.
All right, good to know. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Even without Moser's help, and with all the dead ends we've hit, we refuse to believe that all is lost. Whenever I get frustrated, I remember something Godsey said about the reliability of police and prosecutors when they say evidence is gone.
Just like when you go to your kid who's a teenager, you know, find your piano book in your room and the room's a mess, and they come back to you 15 minutes later and they go, I can't find it. Do you take that to the bank? Of course not.
While working on this project, I saw a headline from South Dakota that gave me hope. Here's Mark Walker, a reporter with the Argus Leader, explaining the 1990 case against a man named Stacy Larson.
Stacy Larson, basically in the murder, is accused of taking a shotgun while he's driving down a highway on a foggy night in South Dakota and shooting the shotgun while he's driving at a couple that was next to him.
Ronald Hilgenberg was killed and Stacy Larson was sentenced to life in prison. The Minnesota Innocence Project got interested about 10 years ago in the case and asked to see the 6 or so boxes of evidence that were still being housed by the McCook County Sheriff's Office. The sheriff's folks said, sure thing, so the Innocence Project people hopped in a car.
They were driving to South Dakota. They stopped to see Stacy Larson. They made another stop, and then they went to McCook County and then learned that the evidence was no longer there.
So it's not that somebody misspoke and said the evidence is here when it was already destroyed. It's that it was destroyed in that time frame between driving from Minnesota to South Dakota.
Right. And McCook County, as their justification, they always go back to, well, there was an order in place despite the fact that, and the Minnesota Innocence Project says, yeah, we recognize that. You told us that. That's why we filed the appropriate paperwork to preserve that evidence, and there was an understanding. So there's a constant back and forth as to what happened with that evidence and why was it destroyed in the first place.
Innocence Projects focus on cases in which they think someone was wrongly accused, but they need DNA evidence to test. Without the evidence in the Larson case, the Minnesota group couldn't do anything. The case languished for nearly 10 years.
So it's not all lost. As I was getting ready to put out this story, the current McCook County Sheriff, he was doing some spring cleaning of the evidence locker, and basically some evidence from Stacy Larson's case fell out of a box that was a completely different case, just fell out. And he called his attorney and was like, well, I was spring cleaning, was looking at this evidence from this other case, and a bag of evidence from your client's case just kind of fell out onto the floor. Untested evidence that was here the entire time.
That's the headline I spotted. Missing evidence found in sheriff's locker could free inmate. Then in June, there was a People magazine article about a mom-turned-private investigator who spent 4 years making some 750 phone calls. Eventually, she found the quote-unquote lost evidence needed to solve the 1984 murder of her friend, Angie Simoda. Decades-old evidence has been uncovered before. Maybe it'll happen again. Until it does, we're working with what we've got, and we're digging up everything we can. Because some information has been wrong in the original case files, our efforts have led to some uncomfortable moments. Like when I reached out to the son of the late Wince Morris, who was listed on one police record as having been the owner of the Red Ox where Beth worked. Morris's son found my query upsetting. His dad had died when he wasn't even a teenager yet. And besides, he said, he didn't own the Red Ox. He owned the car wash next door. Whoops. Amanda and I visited the Red Ox, which is still standing, in hopes of finding out who really did own it back then.
So I am actually a photographer with the Cincinnati newspaper, and we're doing a bit of investigating on an old story around this town.
Okay.
And 1978, a woman was murdered right down the road, and she used to work here. Were you around back then, by the chance?
No.
Because I know, I think this is still the same building.
Yes, it is. It's the same building.
It's been around a long time then, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Yeah, yeah. It's been probably one of the oldest buildings as far as business-wise.
But back then there used to be like a delicatessen attached to it. That's not part of it anymore?
That's no longer here.
The employee said that the Red Ox was under new ownership. She had no idea who ran it back in 78. So I reached out to Ohio State officials to find out who had the liquor license for the Red Ox back in the late 70s, and I learned that the owner was a man named R.J. Stevenson. He doesn't live in Ohio anymore, and he's quite elderly, but I found his phone number and he called me back.
It's been, 30-some years.
It has. I know, and I'm pushing it. So Elizabeth Andes had been, she had been killed, in case that rings a bell. So one of the employees at Red Ox, it had nothing to do, as far as I know, with her job there, but she happened to work there. And so I was trying to get a sense for whether there were any records of employees from that time, so people who might have known her.
That name is not at all familiar.
Wow, okay.
With me.
Do you remember at all one of your employees getting murdered?
No, and I would have remembered that, I'm sure.
I would think so, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't mean to laugh because it's obviously not funny, but I would think that would.
No, I wouldn't. I'm sure I would have remembered that, whether it was leased out to an individual or not.
Right. Okay. Wow.
It would have been nice if police had talked with Stevenson back in 78, when it still would have been possible to get a list of best coworkers to interview. For us, it's a swing and a miss.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
So we tried to figure out what avenues we could still pursue. For starters, I asked forensic pathologist Daniel Spitz to re-examine Beth's autopsy report. I met Spitz in Michigan, where he's medical examiner in Macomb County.
She's got, looks to be strangulation-type injury. She's got multiple stab wounds. He talks about the extent of the injury in the neck. I don't know if he can really tell how much is from strangulation and how much is from the stabbing, because there's so much bleeding, I'm sure, related to maybe both, that it's hard to tell. He seems to put a lot of evidence in the fact that, or a lot of weight in the fact that there's a lot of hemorrhage and injury in the neck, and that it's out of proportion to a ligature strangulation. If you were dealing only with a strangulation and you knew it was only strangulation, then I might agree with him. But when you have multiple stab wounds in the neck, there's a lot of bleeding and whatnot that might be related to the stabbing and not related to the strangulation.
Spitz wasn't as certain as the original pathologist that Beth had not been sexually assaulted.
It looks to be like it could be some type of sexual assault. She's got injury to the genitalia, although back then they did the swabs, which really are not that helpful.
Yeah,
no DNA collection.
Right. Can you walk me through that back then? Because that is kind of we're going on the the idea that she wasn't sexually assaulted, but the tests have changed. So, and, you know, we obviously can't
examine. Yeah, you really can't tell. I mean, she's got injury there, a laceration, which is kind of a weird, I mean, usually it's bruising, tearing. But anyway, there seems to be injury there. She's bound up. Many times strangulations in young women are correlated with sexual assault, or at least attempted sexual assault. You know, they did, they looked for sperm and didn't find any in a swab, but that's not that uncommon.
Why is that not that uncommon?
Well, I mean, you're not, the sensitivity of the test is just not that great. You know, I mean, you're not looking for DNA. Now we don't even look for it. You don't even really bother to look for that. You just look for DNA because it's a much more sensitive test.
Another avenue we could pursue was a more in-depth examination of the crime scene photos. The images aren't the greatest. They're digital scans of photos. But we did notice a few things. Here's Amanda and I trying to sort out our thoughts on this one afternoon in the little office I've dubbed our war room.
From what we read in the case file, there's mention of Buzz saying they drank Pepsi and wine the night before, and that they watched a movie on TV. The TV is in her bedroom, we noticed from the photos. And you can also see an empty bottle of Pepsi, or presumably empty bottle of Pepsi, on the kitchen counter, in the kitchen. And on a table next to her bed in the room where the crime happened, there is a glass on a small table, so you can see that it has a dark liquid in it, which I presume could be Pepsi.
And the thinking here is that the statement doesn't say where they watched this movie, but right. The TV we see is in the
only the only TV we see is in the bedroom,
right.
And TV wasn't as common back then, like having multiples wasn't as common, so it makes sense that, all right, it might have used to be in the living room, but she moved it into her bedroom since she was the only one around.
Right. Like, we see a bunch of bottles on the kitchen counter. But it doesn't look it's messy. It looks like it's getting ready to be packed.
Right.
Like everything looks...
And so those cups that are on the small table by her bed, as far as I can tell, aren't even on the evidence list.
Right.
So they weren't... They took the table, but not the cups.
Right. Right.
So they couldn't even fingerprint the cups.
So if they had taken the cups and kept the cups... Today, we could maybe do DNA evidence on the cups.
Yeah.
That would at least verify or not one of the statements.
The issue with the TV stuck with me for days. I really wanted to know if the only TV in Beth's apartment was the one in her bedroom, because if it was, that would make the Buzz call visit seem even more bizarre. He doesn't describe one way or another where they hung out in the apartment. But you would think he would have remembered it if it had been in her tiny bedroom. I called Young to ask what he remembered about the TV.
But you don't remember having one in the bedroom?
One? No, I don't.
You didn't? Are you pretty sure?
I remember. Yeah, I'm pretty sure, because I don't know where it would have been. There was the bed, there was the little shelf next to the bed, and the dresser, and I don't really remember there being anything else in there. Closets, a closet door, but sliding doors, I think, but I don't remember there being a TV in there.
Photos of the living room show much of it was in boxes. So it makes sense to me that she might be more comfortable watching shows in her room instead. But was it there that night when Buzz Call hung out? And if so, would she really have watched a movie in her bedroom with him? And would he really not remember that kind of setting? Most people I've reached out to in reporting this case have been incredibly willing to help. including John Shea, the surprise roommate who lived with Beth, Bob, and Sue, but whose name doesn't show up in any of the original files.
It sounds like, you know, now that I think of it, you know, really there's a lot of missing pieces that weren't followed up on, and I'm probably one of them. You know, it's like, it's kind of weird that somebody that would have lived there never been asked question one.
We do still have 6 unidentified fingerprints and 2 palm prints, which might be helpful to identify. Jeff Robinson says those prints have been uploaded to all the different fingerprint databases and nothing has hit, meaning that the system has never matched one of the prints to anyone else who's been entered into the database. During the 79 trial, a forensic expert testified that the prints had been compared to ones submitted by Buzz Call, Sue Parmalee, Sue's father, Bob Young, Beth Andes, and even one hand of Boyd Glasscock, because for some reason that's all police ever tracked down. But the expert testified that none matched. I asked John Shea if they might be his prints.
You know, my prints should have been, you know, kind of all over the place, depending on, you know, mostly in Sue's room, I think, and whatever bathroom or kitchen, you know, stuff that you'd normally find them on, you know, how often they get wiped off, I don't know.
Right.
You know, there had to have been, I would think, somewhere in there, you know, my prints.
So if the, and I'm not suggesting that they will do this, I'm just curious if you would be game, if one of the current investigators was like, hey, we should try and eliminate you after the fact, do you mind, in terms of whether these prints are yours, would you be willing to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be able to
hear. Yeah.
I just want to know how useful these remaining prints are, because if they're yours and you were in Aspen, obviously they're not as useful as I was hoping they were. But if they're not yours, then maybe they are still useful.
We passed along John Shea's information to Oxford's Lieutenant Robinson. Last we checked, John's still waiting to hear from him. We know that for Lieutenant Robinson, this must be an awkward case to pursue. While he's an Oxford transplant, he knew about the case long before pro bono attorney Deb Lydon came knocking. Robinson had come up in the ranks admiring legends on staff like Pat Baird and Richard McVeigh. So he'd heard many times of Beth's case, and with each telling, he also heard about the trial and what a disappointment it was that a guilty boyfriend walked free. Robinson also works routinely with Michael Moser, who has the power to decide whether the cases Robinson has investigated are strong enough to be tried. I asked Robinson if he had faced pushback after he started looking at the case.
Yeah, I really don't want to say one way or the other.
He was wishy-washy. Later, he warned me that some people might not be as willing to talk about the case with me as he's been.
There's probably going to be some pushback, I would imagine, and I don't know who this is going to be from my agency, but there's going to be some pushback for you that the correct person has tried.
He's right. There's definitely pushback that Bob Young's the culprit here. All I can say is 2 separate juries said otherwise. In my heart, I feel that somewhere inside a dusty box, there sits the evidence that will finally prove it one way or the other. But I'm still looking. Next time on Accused.
Excuse me, Mr. Moser.
Hi.
I'm Amber Hunt with the Enquirer. I've been trying to set up a meeting with you for some time. Yeah. Do you happen to know where the evidence is in the Elizabeth Andes case?
This is a special project from the Cincinnati Enquirer, narrated by Amber Hunt, produced by Amanda Rossman, edited by Amy Wilson, and engineered by Stephen Baum at Cincinnati Public Radio. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. To look at case documents, photos, videos, and more, visit cincinnati.com/accused podcast.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.